Okay, great. So I'm Rick Hansen. This is the 7th, right, of January 2015. And I've myself been very recently very absorbed in creating a lot of content, doing a lot of work. And as we enter the new year, I thought it would be useful to reflect on our relationship with work, broadly defined. Because for most people, the way they will spend most of their hours, literally the largest single category for most people, is in the realm of work, broadly defined. It could be making a home, raising children, tending to an aging parent or a relative, doing something very, very creative with music or art or dance, or getting on the bus, going into the city and working 8, 9, 10 hours and coming home and taking a big breath and doing it again the next day. Whatever the form of work might be for someone. And in the Buddhist tradition, as you probably know, the essential focus is on what leads to suffering and what leads to, as the Buddha put it, that highest happiness, which is peace. That most fundamental sense of clarity and wisdom and love and calm and joy and gratitude. That highest happiness, which is peace. So that's the frame in which I want to talk about right livelihood. And I don't think I've ever given a talk on wise or right livelihood. I'm seeing heads shaking like, I really never have. So I thought I could talk about it. All right, it's okay for that? Right. And I really encourage you to sort of relate to what I'm talking about a little bit as kind of like a pre-flight checklist, sort of like, fine, ought to pay more attention to that one. Fine, total disaster. Fine. Okay, so something like that. See what's relevant for you. So in terms of what the Buddha talked about, as you may know, in the Noble Eightfold Path, the fourth noble truth, he has eight elements, one of which is wise or right livelihood. So turning to the Buddha to see what he has to tell us about this, it's not much. He says, basically, right livelihood is avoiding wrong livelihood. And wrong livelihood, yeah, really. And wrong livelihood basically is not, is, I'll say it like this, wrong livelihood is trading in weapons. Remember, this is 2,500 years ago. Trading in living beings, which I take to include animals, but certainly during the time of the Buddha, there were human slaves. Trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, and trading in poison. Now, I suspect there might be a bit of squirming in maybe one chair in this room, but on the whole, we don't, I think, trade in, most of us, if not all of us, don't trade in weapons or intoxicants or poisons or living beings or meat, right? So we don't have a lot of help there, particularly. So I want to turn to what are called the five hindrances and apply them to the notion of right livelihood. And as usual, I'll just kind of move through this and really try to preserve time for talking about this amongst ourselves, okay? So as you may know, in one of his many lists, best we can gather, the Buddha said, well, there are these five things that hinder progress. You could think of them almost a little bit as sort of like your natural tendency is to move into Buddha nature, which I think is really true. But, like a car parked on a hill, those chocks or something under the tires, they hinder the forward movement of the vehicle. So what is it that hinders us? The five hindrances, so-called, are what's called sensual desire, pursuing pleasure of one kind or another in ways that are problematic, hatred or ill will, being angry at what's unpleasant. That's the second major hindrance. The third one is interesting. It's called sloth and torpor, sort of laziness, but sleepiness, indolence, not getting up, not doing it, or more subtly, feeling immobilized, feeling frozen, dissociating a little bit, spacing out, not able to put it in gear. Fourth hindrance, interesting term as well, restlessness and remorse. Those get put together in an interesting way. I'll talk about them as might relate to work. And then the last one is doubt. Doubt is a hindrance. Okay. So I want to kind of go through livelihood and work in a Buddhist framework as best I can do it, looking at each one of those, right? And so for the first one, it's interesting to reflect on the ways in which greed gets us into trouble and what the fine line is between aiming for a goal, what I call aspiration without attachment, and tipping into something that's problematic. People can, certainly see for themselves different tipping points where they kind of get into trouble. And I want to just call out a couple that have been relevant for me that might be relevant for you. So one form of greed, one seeking of sensual desire, is the desire to be important. I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Matrix. I'm thinking of it right now. The sort of betraying character in the movie at one point is talking with one of these, Mr. Smith, I think it is. And this character says basically, I want to forget all this that has happened. I just want you to put me back into the waking dream, essentially, that you put me back in the dream. And the guy, Mr. Smith, the bad guy, says essentially, okay, you can have anything you want. What do you want? He says, I want to be important. Right? Make me an actor. But anyway, just like an inside joke in the movie world. But anyway, so there's that desire, and it's subtle sometimes, to impress, to be important, to kind of elbow our way forward, to be good enough to be, wanted by the cool kids, to sit at the head table. And I think it's worth calling out, where does this subtle motivation slip into our own work life? It has totally slipped into my own work life, especially when I was younger. Part of it was the desire to fill that hole in my own heart where I just hadn't gotten enough healthy narcissistic supplies as a kid. So I was longing for that, and I was, in sometimes quite awkward ways trying to fill that hole. That's really the problematic greed for sometimes called narcissistic supplies, being important, being more important than someone else. Is really different from what we would wish for somebody else in terms of feeling respected and worthy and wanted. And I think that's a real test. If it would be appropriate to wish this for somebody else, is it okay to wish it for me? And that's really calling out, because the self is really caught up in, especially in many modern jobs. How many Facebook likes do you have? Right? How many fans? How many page counts? What are your unique visitors? All these metrics. How many Twitter followers? Whatever. All this strange world. It's so much about a big popularity contest. And it's really subtle. We can get very caught up in it. So I just want to call that one out. And a second one I want to call out is around the fine line around persuasion. So I got a very interesting email from a very thoughtful person, coincidentally in New Zealand, where I'm going to be in 3 weeks, and he might want to talk to me, right? And basically what he said in his email was that he didn't want to get advertising messages from me. Very interesting. And he said that receiving unwanted advertising messages from me was to him un-Buddhist and felt like grasping. And I really appreciate that that inquiry. Factually, I send out something to about 100,000 people every week. That's the Just One Thing. That's the scale of it. And so I think a lot about what am I sending to people and why, right? And in our culture, and this is something many Buddhist organizations and individuals have really grappled with, as well as other people and other frameworks, what's appropriate in terms of selling? What's appropriate in terms of pitching? I don't like getting pitched. I don't like pitching. And yet if we don't pitch in some way, it's very difficult to cut through the noise. What's that line? And I'm not saying for myself that I have the ultimate. I don't think there's an absolute answer. I think standards vary. I think people disagree on what's okay and what's not okay. I find that a couple things stand out here. For me, the question is, are we itting the people on the receiving end? Are we thinking of them as things or means to our own ends rather than real beings? Second, is there respect for them on the receiving end? You know, do you have a sense of respect? In my own case, as I wrote this man, his email is something I've thought a lot about over the last five or seven years. I've had a lot of pressure on me to advertise a lot more. And I really have thought a lot about what's the absolute minimum necessary. And also, when is it okay to use up some goodwill you've accumulated, hopefully for the sake of a good end, coming close to a line and then backing away from it, which essentially I feel I've done, because you've probably been on the receiving end of some of my pitching. And it has accelerated in the last year, but we're on a path now of, you know, dialing it back way down again. And so I just want to say that it's very interesting to explore, when does it feel okay to you to be persuasive, to try to persuade, and when does it feel like it's gone too far? Or when do we feel like we're on the receiving end of someone selling us? And it feels okay, it's straightforward. And when does it feel like it's gone too far? It's an interesting line to follow there. And you know, I just want to, again, call that one out around persuasion. How much is enough? How much is too much? You know? And I'm still continually myself trying to find, you know, what is that respectful place. So, okay so far? So it gets very real, doesn't it? You know, it's very real. Okay. So much for greed. Now, I'm obviously not doing a whole thing on right livelihood. I'm just hitting some headlines that have been very relevant to me. Second one is the thing about ill will or hatred, where we're angry at things. And I think where this gets very interesting is that sometimes people, myself included, motivate ourselves to working long hours through anger. You know, we're angry at the competition, we're angry at the undone task, we've had it with feeling judged about not getting stuff done. You can see the gesture of that, you know? And, or we just want to beat them, or, you know, And you can feel it. Or we're angry at ourselves. We're like mad at ourselves in some way. And I think that if you can detect that quality of anger at oneself, hatred is a very charged word, but it's the translated word. I think it's a powerful one to kind of imagine. Is there hatred for ourselves? Are we caught up in hating the competition? Do we hate the undone tasks? You know, I can access states of mind where I look at my to-do list. I've got that checked off, that checked off. I see what's left. It's like, ugh. You know, that's interesting, isn't it? Like hating the undone task. That's weird. You know, all that pile of stuff to file. Ugh, I hate it. Yeah? That's not helping us. That's not helping other people. And it's a hindrance. It's interesting to disengage from. Right? So that's to take away there, if you like, is to look for subtle forms of aversion or anger or kind of an annihilative impulse toward different aspects of your work life. Okay? Sloth and torpor. That's a really interesting one, because to be blunt, and this is really true for me, for many years, I would say decades, and I think it's really true for lots of other people as well, for every person who's just bizarrely driven toward their aim, I think there are 5 or 10 or 20 people, that would apply to me for quite a while, who are kind of sitting on their hands about their own dream, the thing they really want to do, that poem, that book, that song, that nonprofit they want to found, that stop sign they want to help get going, there's a kind of inertness. And a lot of that, honestly, comes down to a fear of a shaming attack if we stick our necks out. You know, so we tend to, I think, swerve. There's often a swerving, you know, where we go, you know, I really would like to do that, and I'm gonna polish that chapter more before I send it off, right? Or we want to connect with other people, and we find reasons to delay having lunch with them. We swerve away. We stay torpid. We stay inert, kind of immobilized. Maybe there are reasons for that, you know, in our childhood, feeling, you know, we took a big swing in eighth grade and we struck out totally in life or something, and, you know, we're afraid to take another swing. But again, I just want to raise the question, you know, is there an indolence, you know? The four words that I routinely think about as descriptors from the Buddha of real sincere practitioners are ardent, which is to say heartfelt, enthusiastic, passionate, ardent, resolute, diligent, and mindful. You know, certainly the first three of those words, ardent, resolute, and diligent, really do speak to sloth and torpor. That's worth asking ourselves, you know. It's one thing to not get caught up in the kind of manic hamster wheel chasing of the prize that is so much of American business culture. But it's another thing to just defer day after day that thing you'd like to really do. And I've just seen again and again that where this issue shows up is around an hour a day. That's roughly the scale of it for most people most of the time. You know, it's that extra hour a day, which if it were applied, half an hour in the morning and half an hour at night maybe, you know, to that extra thing would gradually accumulate over the course of a year to really, really make an enormous difference. So I'll give you a really concrete example of it that just kind of landed squat in my face the other day. Think about a book, right? Books seem like pretty big things. You know, in round numbers these days, kind of a typical, let's say, self-help nonfiction book, what would I know about that? It's about 50,000 words, okay? Seems like a lot of words. It is a lot of words. Well, if you write 2 pages a day, that's 500 words. And you write 2 pages a day for 100 days, just over 3 months, you have the first draft of your book. Now, it's not that easy to write 2 pages a day, day after day after day. But if you just think of it like that, wow, it really makes a huge difference over time. It's those little things gradually accumulated over time that add up to something really, really big. So again, you might think to yourself, maybe this one, sloth, torpor, nah, not me. Cool, all good. On the other hand, you might look at that and you might ask yourself, you know, huh, is there something that really is in my heart to do that I could dial up my ardency for? That would be healthy and appropriate. Also, maybe is there something in my heart to do that I could be more resolute about? Maybe there's something that's crowding out my deal. I think in many ways the single most powerful factor in daily well-being is what time we go to bed, because it sets up what time we get up in the morning, what we do, and then that sets up our whole day, you know. And maybe in terms of sloth and torpor, giving up that extra hour or two of mindless TV, kind of carb loading, you know, a little extra alcohol there, you know, and then the next morning. So think about that, sloth and torpor, okay? Then restlessness and remorse. You know, I think what the Buddha's talking about there is really two things. And a lot of it's applied to things like retreats, but we can apply it to our work life as well. One is this tendency to dart from thing to thing to thing restlessly. And in other words, we don't finish something solidly. We have a lot of half-finished things. And you know, I myself spent probably most of my 20s being a charming dilettante. And now my wife, who knew me then, would say, "Oh, Rick, you're hard on yourself." But there are many ways in which I just casually took on lots and lots of different things as work, but I was nervous about really committing to any one of them, because then I would be established, nailed to it, and that made me very nervous. So I darted from thing to thing to thing. And again, that's worth asking ourselves in our in the productive areas of our life. Do we flit from thing to thing? Or do we take a breath, relax, and complete it? Do we finish it? You know, how many undone things are floating in our lives that are clogging our pipes? And it would be so much simpler to just finish that thing and then finish the next thing and then finish the next thing, right? In terms of restlessness. So I think about that. I kind of offer that. I have a silly saying, you know, nothing digs ditches like shovelfuls of dirt, right? There is something about just doing it and then you're finished and it's done. And again, I don't want to frame this at all. I don't feel it as any kind of hectoring lecture. It's more like, wow, what is there for us to see about our own spiritual practice in this area, right? Especially in this part of our life that occupies a big, big fraction of it. And then remorse. Remorse is really interesting because as a hindrance, why would the Buddha name remorse? Remorse seems in some sense healthy, right? It's where we feel bad about something we did and hopefully it's appropriate remorse. But why would that be a hindrance? And I think what he's talking about is situations where we're caught up in regrets or guilt or shame in a way that's crippling to us, that's problematic, rather than taking action to repair as best we can, knowing that we've repaired as best we can, right? Really doing it for real. And then taking a big breath and thinking to ourselves, you know, I've just done the best I could, right? I've just done the best I could. And be at peace, right? Like the people who email me, I so appreciate people who complain because there's almost always something really good in it and there's almost always something really, you know, good for me to look at and kind of write up. And what I write up becomes an FAQ on our website, so that's pretty good. But anyway, it gets adapted into that. But my point about that is, what's it take to feel complete on your side of the street, even if they're not complete? Maybe they're still aggrieved. Maybe they don't like the way you tried to repair. Maybe they got irritated because you mentioned the fact that, you know, they had a piece of this issue as well, but so be it, right? But on your side of the street, you feel complete. It's coming to completion. I had a teacher a long time ago pointed out that when things are incomplete, they persist in the mind. But when we take it to completion, when we feel complete about it, or we complete a task, we complete a communication, we complete the expression of a feeling, or we complete the knowing of a feeling, it tends to resolve in the mind, and it then disappears, rather than cluttering us, tying us down, tangling us up. Buddha talked a lot about entanglement. I think in many ways what practice is about is disentangling the threads of our experience as experience. So we more and more see its transience and emptiness and we're less caught up in it. And also disentangling ourselves from issues with other people and preventing tangles in the first place. Right? And so in our own mind, we have the right to basically declare disentanglement. You may still be tangled up in that situation with me, but in my heart of hearts, I really feel like I've repaired as much as anyone could repair at this point, and I'm complete with this issue. You know, so that bit. So think about that, how, you know, unhelpful remorse clogs us in situations. You know, for me, the three most hopeful words in the language in a lot of ways are from now on. So many issues are about the past, right? Okay, even if they don't agree with us about the disentangling, from this point forward, what am I going to do? What's the correction I'm going to put in? That really helps deal with remorse as well. Okay, that didn't go well, or, oh, that's the lesson there, or, oh, my point was good, but my tone was not, all right? You know, then I'm going to acknowledge that to myself, make the correction and move on, then I'm not caught up in it. Okay? And then last, doubt. It is said that doubt is the worst hindrance of all. Because, you know, you can doubt anything. You may know the famous saying, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And I just kind of took it as like a cliche, but then I looked into what actually Descartes was doing there. And essentially what he was doing was that people would throw up proofs of existence, that things do exist, right? And he could doubt them. He could find problems with them. Because if you take it all the way down, you can't prove anything ultimately. But what Descartes could not doubt was the fact that he was doubting. See? And literally, the meaning of the word cogito there is not so much I think, but I doubt, therefore I am. Which is a way of saying that doubt is the ultimate corrosion. You can doubt anything. It's very tricky. And yes, there's a place for healthy skepticism. There's a place for healthy, self-guidance, let's call it that. But doubt can become problematic. And where this shows up for me around work a lot is doubting your own worth. Or I think the essence of right livelihood is wholesome ends pursued with wholesome means. You know, do you doubt the wholesomeness of the ends? Well, maybe there's some correction to put in, or maybe there's just a burden there that can be laid down. You don't need to doubt your ends anymore. They're wholesome ends. They're good. Your dream is a good one. You know, this vision of life, it's legitimate. It's worthy. You would wish it for a friend. You would look over there and say, that's a legitimate aim. It's wholesome, okay? And then also, are you pursuing it with wholesome means? Again, maybe there's appropriate correction, but past that appropriate correction, maybe there's an afflictive, you know, a hindering, as it were, self-doubt. I think about the, to someone, probably Linda will have a more exact version of the quote of this, but I think it's something from what Nelson Mandela says, people's, I'm going to paraphrase, you know, where people are really messed up is not because they're bad, it's that they don't trust that they're good, in a nutshell. They don't trust their goodness. And for me, honestly, I'll wrap on this point, and I want to see what you have to say before we end. One of the honest breakthroughs for me was kind of just taking a big breath and saying, what the heck, I don't know, I'm just going to try my best every day. And to sort of give up about doubt and let it set aside and just think, you know, I have a good heart, I have good intentions, I'm going to try hard every day, what the heck, let's have a good time, right? They're going to put that on the tombstone. Not really. Okay, and I want to offer that to you. What's your version of that? Okay, that's the quickie on right livelihood for 2015. What do you think? Comments or questions? Please.
You were talking about, I had somebody come up to me 2 days ago and say, Jerry, you're a really good guy. You know what I mean? And I took it in. I feel like... it's mostly true, but you know, there's just a little bit of doubt. So, do you have any thoughts about how you get to? Yes, I am.
Well, it gets. Yeah, it's a great question. So, just to say it again quickly. So, how do we work with that sort of residue? Where we wonder if we're that good a person, let's say, or we're grappling with really claiming, you know, like feeling really good about ourselves. And, you know, variations on that is, do you love yourself, quote unquote? For myself, to be frank, I don't really know what it means to love oneself. In a sense, I think it means something maybe for some people, but I've never been able to really get it. I get the idea of loving other people, and I get the idea of love, just be love. And I get the feeling, I know what it is to be warm-hearted and for oneself. But this idea that of to really love oneself, I wonder if somehow we've gotten tangled up and people are chasing something that isn't actually that real for them. I don't know. But maybe it is real for some people. So that would be one thing I would say. The second thing I would say is that I think that that territory is a lot about pretty much letting go into Buddha nature, in a sense. Letting go into our, that's just a term for our true nature, just letting go into our true nature. And, you know, then what people are saying to us when they say, you're a beautiful person, is, like I said that to a client of mine day before yesterday, or yesterday actually, and we both got teary. It was very unbidden. It was really true. And I've known her a really long time, and it was very appropriate and startling for both of us, and it had a lot of impact. So I think there's a place where we look at someone, like I could do that for literally each one of you, including a lot of people I don't know at all, or first time coming, or people I knew just a little bit. I could authentically do that. I suspect you could do it as well, right? You get that feeling, wow, you're a beautiful person, you know? But part of that is there's the screen of the, or the screen as in the surface aspect of the person. But mostly what we're registering when we register they're a beautiful person is just the beauty in everyone, right? And the path, I think, for a person can become increasingly just to give over to, I'm going to use a really charged word, to give over to the saintliness that's inherent in everyone. And what's your practice with giving over to the saintliness that's already present inside you? Doesn't mean you are a saint, but there is a saintliness, I think, that's accessible to all of us. Yeah. And then can we do our livelihood from that saintliness? What's that mean to you? That's pretty neat, isn't it? To give over to that current.
Jerry, you hear that? I have heard that, and what comes from out of me involuntarily, or to me involuntarily, is gratitude for the opportunity for whatever it is I did that elicited this thought from the other person. But, you know, that's about it for me. Now, did I understand you to say that Descartes said, I doubt, therefore I am, or I doubt, therefore I doubt I am, or I
or, my
the other one is I think, therefore I think I am. That was Wes Nisker saying that.
Yeah.
But which is it now?
My very not philosophy major understanding is he was playing around with, like I said, proofs of existence, and he pointed out that you could doubt anything, but you can't doubt the fact that you're doubting. See what I mean? You're caught up in it. It's like a loop. But the larger point for me, not as a philosopher, really practically, is just, you know, to be careful about doubt. Doubt's something to be careful for, especially if you're good at it. I know there's some of you in the room. I'm married to someone who's good at doubt. And, you know, it's very useful, but it can be, you know, not taken. It can be taken too far. Anyway, so I have just a question for you as we finish up here. And maybe this will be like a moment, well, maybe we'll just do this as a reflection. If you just take a little time, like imagining this here, you can imagine it, you know, sort of as a 12-month journey, more or less, you know, as it looks like, you know, it's a sweep of time, but it's a fairly familiar rhythm, fairly familiar bite. And if you imagine the broad area of work, broadly defined, family, occupation, income, creativity, avocations even. What's the wisdom that's emerging for you tonight about any kind of subtle course correction in your involvement with work? Maybe your work at this stage is being retired in a way that feels productive and generative and meaningful to you, whatever that might be. What's your course correction? What are your takeaways from tonight? And especially, what's the felt sense in your own body of that course correction, of that which you want to give yourself over to increasingly, you know? over the course of this year. How about we sit quietly for a minute and wrap up, just kind of marinating in the body sense of what is it you want to give yourself over to as a change of some kind in the realm of work over the course of this year. Thanks for your intention. Oh, thank you, Will. And I'll just say one last thing really quickly. I'm just reflecting there for myself. Perhaps other people had a similar thought. You know, a lot, I think it's easy to lose touch with the roots of our work. The roots of our work very often are very loving, right? Loving, giving, generous. Those are the roots, but we're up here grinding through one more task, one more meeting, one more memo, one more email, you know, one more financial analysis, something like that. And I think a lot, you know, it's important to keep coming back to those roots of the love and the benevolence and the generosity and the creative expression and the fun, you know, the passion that's at the root, and link it in our mind. You know, I'm writing this email, I'm crafting this sentence, I'm talking with this person, I'm selling this car, whatever it might be, right? In a way that's linked back down to those roots. And to keep mindful of the connection between, you know, the surface expressions of our work up here and our deep, loving, good intentions down here that are the basis for them. Anyway, that's true for me. That's my hope for this year. You are all really beautiful people. I'll see you in a month or so. Take care. Bon voyage. Bon voyage.
Schedule New Zealand where you're going to be, because I have relatives there.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.